We'll go ahead and get started. We may have some people wandering in after another minute or two, so. But we'll go ahead and get started with the discussion. My name is Gloria Gonzalez. I'm the Deputy Energy Editor at Politico. I've been an energy and environmental reporter for 20-plus years, and one of the topics that I've covered quite often is flooding and the implications and ramifications of flooding risk. Flooding risks obviously have evolved, and we all know that it's no longer a coastal issue. Every state in the United States is affected, other countries are affected, and very severely at times. We are in the city of Houston, which obviously has dealt with a major flooding challenge, but it still needs to ensure that the devastation of Harvey isn't. So we'll talk a little bit about how the risk has evolved and what the solutions are. You know, what's happening on the local level, what are the options, what solutions haven't been explored yet, and we're going to talk a little bit about one particular type of solution related to flooding, and that's buyouts. And we are very happy to be unveiling the findings for a report that Matthew's going to talk about in a little bit that really digs into the buyout solution and what are the challenges, what are the benefits, and how we could work at the local level. So, but first we're going to talk a little bit with Sam. Sam's going to take us through how have he seen the flooding risk evolve over the years through his research, and talk a little bit about some of the adaptation and mitigation strategies that he's seen that have worked on the local and state level.
Thank you, and thank you for having me today. I'm Sam Brody. I'm a professor at Texas A&M University, and I direct the Institute for Disaster Resiliency for the state of Texas. And I've been working in the area of flood risk as a researcher and practitioner for 25 years. And I can tell you that all the data indicators strongly suggest that the problem is getting worse. Flood impacts are getting worse. We're loading up flood risk in a way that we have never seen in previous decades. And the major drivers of this risk aren't so much changing rainfall patterns, sea level rise, changing environmental conditions, climate change. Wait 60 years, but more so from the built environment, the way we in our parking lots, all of that changes the way that water moves across these low-lying, in this case, coastal lands. I've lived here for 30 years. I've never flooded. Why am I flooding Houston? But echoes all over the United States. So while the problem is getting worse, I've seen and been involved in a lot of change, both at a federal level and have the privilege to work with a few over the years, but also at a state level and the governor of Texas. Unfortunately, it takes a monster storm to create change and open that policy window, which makes us a reactionary society, which is part of the problem. But that being said, Hurricane Harvey in 2017, which is the largest urban flood event in U.S. history, and I'm sure we will not recover from that storm before the next big storm. That really triggered a lot of positive change that has also rippled across the country. I was lucky enough, I say that tongue-in-cheek, to be pressed to write the after-action report, Eye the Storm, for the governor. We did all the data analytics and wrote the mitigation sections. And they work that's now published and used elsewhere, and it was like four components. I had like 30 seconds to explain to the governor with a picture what this was at the Texas legislature. There's no legislature to fix that. Avoidance, get out of the way, accommodation, let it flood, and communication, tell the story of risk, which the reason I'm dragging myself out of bed this morning to be here is that is so important. And that is a real failure all over the United States, risk communication, and it's driving a lot of these problems, and you guys are the biggest touch point for that. And so I think it's really important to engage that work that they embrace and need to, like, what do we do about this problem? Now that the window is wide open and they know FEMA's at a state level, I was lucky enough to get involved in what is now the strongest flood risk real estate disclosure regulation in the country. Probably the most ambitious watershed management flood planning initiative in the country. The the largest and most ambitious data integration. We call it TDIS, the Texas National Information, to communicate them to the. And I would say Texas is, this week, I would, they told me I can't say off the record, but on the record, probably the most flood-resilient state in the country right now. However, the action is at the local level. And, you know, that's where the rubber hits the road for mitigation and adaptation. And that's really spotty. Houston is the poster child for change, right? There's so much great stuff going on in Houston. But generally, the local level where the action needs to take place is, it's a really still a problematic thing. But in Houston, you know, you're going to hear that Houston, even before Harvey, had more flood buyouts. And I don't like the word buyouts. And I get a lot of resistance from Texans when I say buyout, because it triggers eminent domain feelings and rage. But Houston now has, in Harris County, I can't believe they got it passed, the strongest freeboard, so elevation requirement for new builds, at 2 feet over the 500-year flood level. That's insane. Like, all my life, I'm like, if we get 2 feet over the 100-year level, that would be awesome. And under the Obama administration, that's what we were suggesting when it kind of got out a little bit. This is higher than that. So there's a lot of great stuff happening. And I'll just conclude by saying that, you know, to me, avoidance strategies is the way to go. All the research I've done at multiple opportunities that, for obvious reasons, reduces losses, risk and associated losses the most. And that can be vertical, pulling away from these vulnerable areas, whether that's setbacks, buffers, or open space protection, a lot of buyouts. And, you know, there's a real opportunity there, and you're going to hear the Pew's amazing report. They do amazing work. I'm like a commercial for Pew today. But that's one strategy many strategies across those four categories of that framework, and they all need to work synergistically. And so we're going to hear highlights of strategies, but realize that we need to take a programmatic perspective and understand that you can't just buy. Just buying out isn't going to help. There's a lot of stuff we need to do where we buy out, we are going to have to build some walls, and I don't know if we need to do any more channeling. That's impossible at this point. But you know, there's a range of activities, and it's that recipe, that synergy, that's for each local community that's going to really make the difference. But again, avoidance, I think, is the cornerstone as we move forward. And I'll let Matthew talk more about that. So that's kind of all my remarks. And I, you know, while we're going the wrong direction, we're making really good progress in different local communities in Texas. And I get a lot of journalists wanting me to say things, negative things, but, you know, right now, after the last 4 years, there's been amazing stuff. Country, nationally leading policies and activities taking place. And I hope you'll hear more from a local Houston perspective and a Biden perspective. And I'm here if you need to talk to me after. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Matthew, can you talk a little bit about your report? There were some really interesting findings that I wanted us to dig into a little bit, but why don't you give us an overview of some of the findings, the high-level findings, as you your research came together.
Verbiage. And while I agree with you in spirit, I'm going to say the word buyout a lot in the next few minutes. So first of all, good morning. Thank you all for being here. I'm Matthew Sanders, the Senior Manager with the Pew Charitable Trust Flood Prepared Communities Project. Pleased to take the opportunity to share with you our new report that we're releasing today, titled Property Buyouts Can Be an Effective Solution for Flood-Prone Communities. Before I get into the new report, for those of you that may not be as familiar with the Pew Charitable Trust, we're a global non-governmental organization that seeks to improve public policy and invigorate civic life through research and advocacy with a commitment to facts, science, data, and measurable results. Commensurate with these values, Pew's flood it for a moment and lay out a few facts to give urgency to our floods work. Flooding is the costliest and most common natural hazard, costing the nation more than $1 trillion in damages and economic losses since the year 2000. Flood damages and losses affect every state in the United States. In the last 4 years alone, all 50 states that have been covered under a federal major disaster declaration. Just last year, President Biden approved disaster declarations for more than 25 flood-related events. As a native New Orleanian, I know firsthand the devastating impact floods can have on communities and how long it can take for those communities to recover. Personally, seen countless flood survivors show extraordinary resilience in the face of disaster, but no individual, family, or community can be asked or should be expected to withstand and bounce back from floods that are becoming more frequent and more severe. That's why pre-disaster mitigation. So I'll take a moment to repeat that point in a different way. We're past the time by which many of these communities will have to space protection for every flood-prone community. That will need to consider relocation. But Pew's new report, which emanates from consultations with government practitioners across the country, highlights significant challenges states and localities face in planning for, developing, and implementing bio projects. First, even in flood-prone areas where many residents want to relocate, the issue could be practically and politically fraught, with community members and public officials reporting that buyout assistance is too slow, limited, and difficult to access. The report also notes concerns that buyout programs often fail to benefit the most at-risk residents. Conversely, buyouts have been criticized for unfairly targeting communities of color or those with little political influence, effectively gentrifying neighborhoods in the name of flood prevention. Federal efforts to promote and improve local pre- and post-disaster planning are poorly coordinated, which creates hurdles for state and local buyout initiatives following flood disasters when they are in greatest demand. This poor coordination and collaboration across levels of government limit the effectiveness of outreach, engagement, and flood risk awareness efforts. As a consequence, communities that lack pre-disaster planning often consider property buyouts only in the days and weeks following the flood, when officials and residents are overwhelmed, traumatized, and under-resourced. It's also important to note there is no federal buyout program. Rather, funding for buyouts comes from multiple federal agencies and programs, which can make it difficult for communities to identify the best funding source for their buyout strategy. Additionally, in some flood-prone communities, local officials resist buyouts for fear of reducing their tax base. The liability and burden associated with the long-term maintenance of acquired property often makes buyout programs unattractive to local governments. Finally, buyouts are often difficult for residents to contemplate, as they come with the fear of disrupting a cherished sense of community. I've experienced this firsthand. Prior to my time at Pew, I was an official in Louisiana state government, where I developed and led several buyout and relocation efforts. I spent a lot of time on porches and in living rooms, working directly with residents and hearing from them how difficult and emotional it is to contemplate retreat. With these challenges in mind, Pew believes buyouts can be more effectively utilized with a few common sense tweaks in policy combined with a greater emphasis on community-led planning. Pew's recommendations focus on federal policies because most buyouts are wholly or largely funded with federal resources and because the rules and regulations governing federal funds influence state and local efforts. The report's recommendations hone in on actions federal departments and agencies, particularly FEMA, can take quickly and without needing legislative action by Congress. Federal program rules should give funding grantees the flexibility to combine multiple funding sources to address diverse needs within a flood-prone area, while also supplementing those resources with state and local funds. Following a disaster, and in collaboration with other federal partners, FEMA should deploy dedicated staff with specific training and knowledge about buyouts to help state and local officials. Moreover, federal agencies funding buyout programs should reward communities with a track record of innovation and leadership in standing up and implementing buyout programs, encouraging similar initiatives elsewhere. This should include enhanced funding flexibility for these established programs, including potentially reducing or eliminating the need to calculate cost-benefit ratios for projects in designated areas. In response to the concerns of residents with deep, long-standing attachments to their homes and communities, the federal government should allow for and promote the use of life estates to acquire property, as it allows homeowners to remain in their homes for the rest of their lives or until they themselves choose to leave. Federal assistance is needed in developing long-term maintenance plans for acquired properties, as localities may not be able to assume the burden of property upkeep, which means they may not be able to pursue buyouts as a mitigation strategy. The federal government should offer specific trainings and workshops tailored to fit the communities that are developing buyout programs. Such training could help with processes like navigating appraisals, title searches, purchase offers, documentation, and post-buyout land use requirements. State local officials must strategically use federal support and funding to plan for longer time horizons, while working with residents to envision better outcomes through relocation and transition to lives and livelihoods away from rising flood waters. With respect to equity, federal grant criteria should prioritize applicants from under-resourced communities. Through closer collaboration, officials could support more robust and frequent outreach, engagement, and flood risk awareness efforts, and highlight buyouts as a viable and perhaps even advantageous flood mitigation option. All buyout plans should address the potential consequences of relocation for high-risk communities, particularly the disruption of essential social networks and access to vital services. People of color, renters, and those with mobility challenges, and older adults may have compelling reasons to fear moving, including the need to be close to work, family, and community support networks, even when they reside in high-risk areas. Buyout programs that are strategic, equitable, and affordable should be co-designed with these can be agreed upon in a common holistic vision, and a community's shared vision can be developed. To conclude, although the concerns are valid, when developed with an emphasis on equitable outcomes, Pew believes buyouts can and should play an important role in state, helping prevent future impacts while utilizing a natural approach to mitigation, providing an added co-benefit of absorbing stormwater and helping to conserve natural habitat as buyout properties are converted to natural open space. Before I wrap up, I'd like to draw your attention to the materials that you all have on your seats. That include a one-pager on the new buyouts report that also has a QR code on the back that directs you to the full report. Hope you all take a look, and I'm looking forward to answering any questions you may have. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Ryan, I know buyouts are something on to make the city more resilient. Can you talk a little bit about some of the solutions that Houston has been working on, especially since...
Thank you very much for providing me the opportunity to sit with you all. It's always great to join people smarter than myself to learn and take these lessons. Unique challenges and some daunting realities that we would have to address immediately to protect our communities. We always understood riverine flooding as something that we have to be hyper aware of. There are 22 watersheds that cut through the city of Houston. It accounts for about 235 square miles of floodplain. That's about a third, close to 35% of the city of Houston's actual land area is mapped floodplain. So we always understood the threat of riverine flooding. What Harvey made us realize is while 35% of the city is floodplain, 60% of flood damage related from Hurricane Harvey happened outside of the regulatory floodplain. So we now are faced with not only addressing riverine flooding, but we also have to be very cognizant of urban flooding as well for a number of reasons, most of which have already been mentioned, focus on development, and the fact that we are creating more of a tourist stormwater system. Since Hurricane Harvey, we have worked to develop programs that address those concerns. We briefly talked about our floodplain ordinance and freeboard design flood elevation, making sure that we are developing to remove living spaces, critical equipment, things that allow our residents to safely stay in their home in the event of significant flooding, like Hurricane Harvey. It doesn't have to just be a Hurricane Harvey type event. Houston has faced 8 federally declared disasters since 2015. We are really dedicated to reevaluating how we approach these things, and that is the two plans that we have released in the past 2 years that really focus our efforts are Resilient Houston and Houston's Climate Action Plan. The 2-year report was just released. You can find it on the website. You can also go to my little profile on Worldbook to see those documents. They give you a good sense of all of the actions that we are taking to advance Resilient Houston and the Climate Action Plan to create more sustainable, more resilient, more equitable communities throughout the city of Houston. Part of Resilient Houston is leveraging disaster recovery dollars to advance resilient programming. And what I mean by that is we have had a large influx of money from FEMA and from HUD to recover and subsequently mitigate against future disasters. Part of that is $23 million in planning studies from Community Development Black Grant, give or take, is going to give us the opportunity to stand up a number of programs focusing on developing a series of lily pads, so safe harbor for people when natural disasters do occur, to prepare for, to take refuge during, and to recover from natural disasters. So it's little city services, little islands that allow residents to basically have access to us. I don't know if it was made clear, I work for the city of Houston, specifically in the mayor's office of recovery. The second effort is going back to the urban flooding. So part of that planning study is mapping our stormwater infrastructure and better understanding how we need to right size and how we need to prepare for those considerations. We are also modifying our construction code, and we are looking at our hazard mitigation plan, and specific to this conversation, we are developing a buy-in, buy-out strategy. So I think that, like my fellow panelists, that public service organization, at the heart of what we do, we are dedicated to the communities that we serve. And that means protecting them from untenable situations and dangerous situations is important, but part of that conversation that we are really committed to is investing in those communities as well. So in that 230 square miles of floodplain, 160,000 structures exist, 6,000 of which exist in the flood chains, is really, really important to us. But disrupting the continuity of their community is not something that we want to attain. So by buying, for the city of Houston to buy in and to invest in these communities outside of the regulatory floodplain allows for that creation of that buffer between the bayou and the community. We can also increase our affordable housing stock. We can also celebrate the bayou as an amenity, as something that is recreational, that the community can interact with. It doesn't have to give us heartburn every time it rains. You cannot develop in Houston without understanding is really focus on developing a framework through this planning study and understand how can we make those significant investments in a community, create quality, affordable housing stock, and use that as an opportunity to maintain the continuity of the school. We are not disrupting parents from their grocery stores. We are not fracturing a community by a class. So that is something that has been threaded throughout Resilient Houston and our climate action plan, is making sure that our solutions are resilient, that they are sustainable, most importantly, that they are district. And that means robust stakeholder engagement, and that means working with our council districts. There is not a council district in Houston that is not impacted by flooding or does not have a bayou that cuts through it. So really important. The Mayor's Office of Complete Communities is also remarkably important, an initiative to really focus on equitably throughout the city of Houston and making sure that we are focusing on our communities that are most adversely impacted by either natural disasters or even man-made hazards that we have created. We have our approach simultaneously. So we cannot think about flooding in a vacuum. Weatherization, Winter Storm Uri really made us focus on how we are approaching weatherizing not only homes, but weatherizing blocks and ultimately weatherizing communities. All of these things work in tandem with our want to protect and serve our communities, and that is at the heart of what we do. And the buy-in, buy-out initiative, which we have publicly issued an RFP for, and we are currently working on establishing our programming for how this study is going to work, ultimately piloting and creating a framework that is scalable across all of the communities in the city of Houston, of which we have a lot. We have been noted multiple times as being the most diverse city in to serve. So making sure that we are not only developing a strategy.
Tell me a little bit about what you mean in terms of resources that would make that happen, that would allow you to achieve the scale that you need to really address the flooding issue.
Government programs are almost always oversubscribed, so we always have more work than we have money to fund. That being said, the federal government, through FEMA and HUD, has, I think, I know I'm not supposed to say, don't quote me, but I think New Orleans and Houston are the two largest recipients of federal dollars, disaster recovery dollars, from FEMA and from HUD. Well, along with those dollars does come that support staff. We have really good working relationships with FEMA and HUD. We have great working relationships with our state partners, the Texas Department of Emergency Management and the General Land Office. Those conversations and those relationships and the subject matter expertise, subject matter experts are crucial to developing these programs and these projects. And like I said, we've had eight since 2015, so we've had that constant relationship with our federal partners, and maintaining that is critical because it is what is going to help us take this planning study and actually create an executable program that ultimately we want to be sustainable. But that starts with $23 million from the federal government. So I'm certainly very appreciative of it. The buy and buy out program is not going to be $23 million. But that certainly helps us really work through these programs and develop a strategy, a suite of strategies. So keeping that open line of communication is critical. The rest of it will come so long as we maintain those good lines of communication with our partners.
Sam, I'm curious if you have any reactions to some of the findings that Matthew outlined in the Peel report.
Yeah, Brown would say, well, you know, there are three things that are broken about the current bio program that Matthew discussed, but you know, I want you to zero in on it. The first is because it's a microcosm of the problems we have with other strategies as well in this country. So the first is to be bought out, you have to like be flooded over and over again, which is like hitting your hand with a hammer over and over again. So the loss occurs, we put the structure in, the loss occurs, and you know, at the end of the day, maybe you get bought out, right? Or you have an opportunity to relocate. That's so reactionary, and then it's such an indication of this country's approach to flood mitigation, which isn't the approach of other countries out there. That we're, you know, we're never to dig ourselves out of the hole if it's always reacting to some big event. Also note, you know, Houston has a lot of disaster declarations, or the state, but there are many more that go unnoticed where thousands of people flood on an afternoon with this reactionary approach. And this study where we're like, well, as a planner training, what if we didn't have the FEMA constraints and we were to look at vacant lands? And what if we were going to think about acquiring open space before the shovel hits the ground? So this long history of open space acquisition in environmental planning and other types of planning and land use management that communities can draw upon for buying out parcels for flood risk reduction. The other thing is this singular approach, I guess it's number two, something that's four, singular approach to buying out, like you got the benefit cost rate, buyouts, you've got, you know, does it make sense? And I think that unintentionally drives buyouts to lower income communities because you're not going to get a really good benefit cost ratio when you buy out a mansion in River Oaks. So I haven't seen that done. But what about coupling open space protection with ecological value, which is also, you know, the biggest driver that we can find of reducing flooding and flood loss is protecting naturally occurring wetlands, freshwater wetlands. Why not couple that? What about aesthetics? What about proximity to parks and other open spaces so you don't get the checkerboard pattern that's so notorious up in New Jersey and New York? So the third is the procurement process. If I was head of FEMA, which is never going to happen, I would say, no, forget all these programs. Let's just focus on fixing the procurement process. And in a buyout situation, if you're lucky, if you're quick, it takes 2 years. And I have a lot of friends and colleagues who got flooded who would love to be bought out. They're like, I can't wait 2 years. For 2 years, great, but the rest of the world, you can't wait. And you know, that's embedded in your report, and it's so important. And it's not just buyouts. It's, you know, how many homes have we rebuilt? It's not the fact that people don't want those homes rebuilt and they're working hard. It's the procurement process. In my own institute, we just finished. And so that's number three. And then number four is this, you know, what I'd love to talk to you later, Matthew, is this idea of really engaging with local residents. And that's shifting in my mind in Houston in the positive direction. Understanding their needs. I had this great opportunity years ago. I shared a beer in Chicago with a guy who spent all his career working on buyouts in Milwaukee, of all places. And he said, you don't buy people out, you make them whole. And this voluntary nature of buyout shouldn't be a problem if you do it right. Because if you find the right property and you articulate what's going on and the opportunities to reduce risk, people should be, that shouldn't be a barrier. People should want to be bought out. But it's this writing checks, I don't talk about Houston per se, but just in general, buying people out, using the word retreat, which in Texas is a non-starter for obvious reasons. Don't see even say that word in the state. Really signifies the disconnect between well-meaning government programs and really working with individuals. And it sounds like Matthew's done that. He's probably got great comments, you know, insight into that. And it's hard and it's messy and it's emotional. You know, and maybe fortunately I'm a researcher, so I'm not someone divorced from that, but it's so important. And the last thing I'll say, and this I know is going to trigger folks, is that when I do work for Homeland Security and FEMA, I don't want to fly on the wall. I think the time is ending where, you know, Hurricane Harvey, when they call it, like, money that was hit the streets, let me say that, it's around $18 billion. And Houston gets well over $1 billion of that. Those days are over because FEMA is broken financially. They're already today, when this contract weekly is like 20-some billion dollars in debt. They borrow against the U.S. Treasury. I'd love to be able to do that too, for college loans maybe. And so, you know, and again, I'm not saying off Houston in this comment, but generally local communities see the federal government as cash register. That's what they do. Knowing that's ending as disasters are increasing, what does that mean from a local community perspective? There's going to have to be much more investment from localities into this problem. And Houston, you know, when I gaze around Texas and the country, Houston's approach, they got money, they got amazing data, they got amazing people. But what about Sour Lake, Texas, or Ailey for a hour period? These tiny places that don't even know how to apply for federal aid if they were, you know, and don't have the tax base to really invest, like Houston. I live in Houston, so I know they must have a great tax base. The taxes are crazy. Property taxes. That really worries me. And so, you know, I think we're entering a new dawn where FEMA and the federal government is no longer going to unload billions without a congressional appropriation. And I don't know what that means, but it's a really interesting thing to talk about and write about. Sorry, I went too long here.
No, that's good. We at Politico, we actually just recently published a story where we looked into the fact that a lot of local communities, small communities, are going to lose out on infrastructure funding out of wonky technical federal documents that they need to fill out in order to get that funding. So it's definitely a challenge, and I know EPA is providing some technical assistance to help some of these communities, but, you know, is it enough? Does it go far enough?
Can I just one more follow-up? Yeah. So I had this, the sponsor of the bill that created the Institute, Disaster Resilience Texas, he is districts in Houston. We had this conversation about 6 months ago. He's like, Sam, you're enabling the enabled. I'm like, what do you mean? And he explains to me, well, you work with communities who already have the capacity because they're funding, they're the funders. Like Houston, have the data, to have the capacity. You need to go out and help the underserved communities with this institute. I'm like, that'd be great. How about $1 million? So they got us $1 million that just came. And we started a program called TRIP, which is Disaster Risk Infrastructure Program. And it's really about going out to underserved communities, and they don't want me to say rural, they don't want me to say social vulnerability, but that's part of it. And bringing to bear all the analytical capabilities we have in the Institute and our partners, and helping communities understand their risk exposure, understand their problems, not come in and say, this is what we're going to do for you, but go in and say, what are your problems? What do you want us to do for you? Right? You decide. So I don't even know what we're going to do. But that, to me, is a scalable program at the national level where the impact's going to be felt much higher than coming up with better models for Houston or Harris County. And I'm really excited about it. It's probably the most impactful thing that I've done. And it's going to help communities not just understand their risks, solve some of their flood problems, but apply for federal grants. That's part of it, is, you know, to apply for FEMA stuff, you need to know what your risk exposure is. And communities don't even know that. They don't even have maps. So, you know, I challenge all of you to find ways to scale that approach up across the country to make a really important impact. And I'll stop talking.
Indeed. We'll open it up for your speech. But go ahead.
Sure. Thank you very much. I'm Nick Kosar. I've recorded a show. Other things we may read about nature-based solutions, concrete and asphalt. What are those nature-based solutions, and how could they help the communities?
So to repeat the question, what are the nature-based solutions in urban communities, and what do those look like? Matthew, do you want to jump on that first, and then we can see if Ryan and Sam have thoughts?
Yeah, sure. You know, one of the things about cities, urban environments, is you have an abundance of impervious surfaces, right? So when you enact a buyout program in a particular urban environment, water retention capacity of the open spaces that are left behind. You know, one of the things that I'll point to, if you look at Philadelphia, right, so there's been a long-standing program in Philadelphia called Green Acres, Clean Waters, I think. I may be getting that wrong. But essentially, they created a series of parcel-sized pocket parks throughout. You know, I think if you can think of it in aggregate, right, like how much acreage can you open up in a particular urban environment that can then retain additional water capacity, you know, that's really the goal.
So to kind of piggyback on that, the buy and buy out strategy is, in effect, removing built footprints from the flowway from the channel. So allowing, what do the Dutch say, allowing the channel to breathe. And that was something that was at the heart of our Living with Water workshops that we did with the Harris County community stakeholders, was try to develop these solutions that help us live with water. So while a buyout program is at its heart an avoidance strategy, so removing people from fast-moving water, it is also an opportunity for us to develop solutions that allow us to live with water and allow that channel, that value, to expand and contract safely, and allows for infiltration and storage and other programs that are executed by engineers that are smarter than me on how to capture water where it lands, either storing it and slowly releasing it or allowing it to infiltrate into the grass and into the green space that is developed through a buyout strategy. And that is part of a larger effort to repair the waterways and make sure that we are treating that natural amenity of the bayou in a respectful way that is both something that is accessible on blue sky days, but is also something that is not going to encroach on homes in people's lives. So the buyout buy-in strategy is in effect a nature-based solution. We pair that with green stormwater infrastructure investments and incentives that we're standing up, as well as bayou restoration efforts that based on urban forestry and planting 4.6 million new native trees. Like, all of these are solutions that hopefully can mitigate future disasters.
Dutch dialogues, and I think you look at the work that has happened around Dutch dialogues in New Orleans, here in Houston, in Charleston, South Carolina. Recently completed the Dutch Dialogues Plan. I mean, that's a scalable, replicable approach, I think, in cities across the country. The other thing that I'll just sort of add to that is the idea that if you think about flooding from a watershed perspective, right, it's naturally going to be a bigger construct than an individual jurisdiction. And so if a city can think about, water landing in a particular urban environment.
Questions?
Yeah.
Yes, in the back.
My name is Zoe. I'm a reporter for GRIS. I cover miniature trees sometimes, although we don't always call it that. I have so many questions. I'm going to choose one. I want to know whether there's been, this is for Matthew, I think. I want to know whether there's been a quantitative analysis of how much money local governments might lose out on in tax dollars from people moving away from their districts. I mean, has that ever been done? Do we know what the financial incentive is for keeping people where they are and not moving out?
To the impact of financial implications on local governments of people participating in buyout programs and moving out.
What I will point out, there was a piece of Pew-sponsored research that actually just came out a few weeks ago through the Urban Institute on floodplain, right? So it's not even a construct that anybody is really looking at to any degree of specificity. So if you're not anticipating where people may move to and from, there's no way to quantify it the way that you're describing. So we think that's a topic area that really deserves a lot more.
Yes, in the back.
Hi, my name is Nusheen Huck. I'm a freelancer here in Houston. I'm wondering, when you're looking at these buyouts, as far as the renters, as opposed to just homeowners.
So this is a question in relation to the
conflict violence, which is a significant concern. That's one of the policy areas that we highlight in the report that needs to be addressed, particularly at the federal level. There are provisions around uniform relocation and assistance that can be offered to people that are displaced as a result of some type of acquisition activity. There's not a lot of good precedent by which people are considering the plight of renters that are in flood-prone areas. It's a big problem.
I'm so sorry. Just really quickly, the city of Houston, the city of Houston's rental population is about 47%. So it is, we as a municipality, our buyout efforts do focus on multifamily acquisitions. We work with Harris County Flood Control to do single family work, but to the Uniform Relocation Act point, we do have a dedicated team within Housing and Community Development that do our rental population in stock, and we have made significant investment work into developing that affordable housing stock, so in the event of an acquisition, we can work closely with those communities as we possibly can, but into a like-for-like living situation as best we possibly can. I'm happy to put you in touch with us. Find me afterwards. I'm happy to make that connection.
Okay.
Hey,
I'm sorry. Did you want to
read over
that?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
Elisa O'Carr. I'm with Audubon Magazine. And I was wondering, there's been mention of understanding the importance of these communities, where they are within the watershed, about, what's upstream, what's downstream, about working together to better, work together for overall larger flood management.
So the question is about work together, communication between communities that are affected upstream, downstream, and how they may work together to mitigate risk.
That's a huge issue. You know, flooding is simultaneously a very localized issue and a watershed, regional issue. We don't aim our strategies at regional levels. We're going to come with the wrong career. So many times I see not just lack of communication, but tension between victimized because they're responsible for downstream events. So, you know, Weed City Friendswald is just one of many, many of thousands of those examples. The state, at a state level, they started this amazing watershed planning, flood planning initiative, which I, you know, had what they asked me what we should do, and I, what the hell, I'll say it. So, went to the governor and I pushed buyouts, non-starter. Like, I said, how about watershed planning? Yeah, that's great, let's do that. What is that? And that somehow led to over $100 million being put into these watershed planning initiatives that's run by the Texas Water Development Board, and Reem Zaun, Z-O-U-N, is the head of that. She's amazing. She came out of Austin. Amazing what she's doing. And it's bringing these communities together, both by forcing them and providing incentives to have that communication at a watershed level. Now it depends how you carve up the watersheds and which communities you choose, but it's happening. And those plans are, some of them are at the tail end of being, and she can provide amazing insights into, and I did tell her my story, so I don't know if she's talking today because I made a lot of work for her, but it was a really bizarre political experience what happened after Harvey at the state level that I'm happy to share, that resulted in wonderful things. And sometimes that's, and how we allocate billions of dollars of resources. I think, and you know, I feel like I'm in Groundhog Day sometimes, and we had the same conversations in 2001 after Tropical Storm Allison, and then the same conversations, a little different flooding in 2008, and then 2015, and then 2016, and then 2017. And so this, just this constant impact recovery process that people need to realize when they move into this area, that's the reality of living here. The woman who walked out of the room, she's back, that there is some really good work done quantitatively on the cost of keeping people or moving them out. My institute, we've done some work on that, but also in the spirit of not being overly dominant in the conversation. Eric Tate at University of Iowa has done some great work on buyouts and that issue. There's been some great stuff in North Carolina, coming out of UNC Chapel Hill. And Laura Sibenek at University of North Texas, that's her, she focuses on where people go or come from and the financial implications around that from a geographic perspective. So happy to send articles in that. You know, that's another, like, there's tons of stuff done in the peer review journals, but no one reads it, right? I mean, like, I spent the last 20 years writing hundreds of articles, and like three people read it among my friends. And there's some really good stuff in there. And that's where there's this disconnect between the research and the analytics and, you know, your, this stakeholder group and decision and support groups. And it's always been there. I feel like, you know, that there needs to be a shift in change. Google Scholar is one of the big game changer events, right? Get on Google Scholar, you can find all the stuff. And that's, you know, so that's some of my comments around that issue.
Yeah, can I just add to the watershed piece real quick? So Sam mentioned the efforts underway here in Texas. There's similar efforts in Louisiana to wrap their minds around watershed scale planning. North Carolina, actually in their last budget session, passed a provision that funds an effort to develop a statewide, what they're calling a watershed blueprint. Obviously, if you look at Iowa, Sam mentioned Eric Tate, Iowa Watershed Approach. So, you know, it's happening, but in all of those examples, right, those have come after catastrophic flooding events, right? So it's not happening proactively. So that momentum really needs to shift from, you know, from a post-disaster paradigm to a pre-disaster paradigm.
Do you have any?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hi,
Hi, Danielle Flanagan with PY Houston TV, Filipino channel here in Houston. And to your question about the kind of the contentious relationships between upstream and downstream communities on the watershed, you definitely want to contact also, because there is a contentious relationship here in Houston with one particular watershed and another community. I want to also talk to the Gulf Water Justice Institute, and you want to ask for Monique Hardin. And then here in Houston, you want to talk to Tracy Stevens. His pronouns is a he, him. And he's with a coalition called ACTS. And Bridget Murray was the speaker here, ACTS. And after we're done, I'll share that information with you. And it's a really great story about the contentious relationship between an upstream and a downstream system, the Woodlands versus Pleasantville type of thing. So it's not funny, but it's interesting stories to the die of the build out of that. The other question I had too is in looking at the complete communities, the list on there doesn't include community of Fifth Ward. And Fifth Ward's been mentioned a lot throughout this conference, tours and all. Is there a rationale for that community not being included in the landscape for complete communities and receiving some of the same attention as the other ones? I think it's like Cashmere and Gardens. That's nearby them, that they are designated as a complete community.
So the question is related to the Fifth Ward not being included in the complete communities subprogram.
I am happy to put you in touch with Director Blanks to answer that question. I do not feel I'm qualified to speak to the rationale on how they identify communities. I think it's important to put you in touch with the right people. So, yes, ma'am.
Okay, gotcha.
And I'm happy to put you in touch with our director of communities.
And then we also noticed we were looking at the numbers from EPA and EGF here on the FEMA distribution of dollars after Hurricane Harvey, and they went significantly toward what they call outside the arrow communities here in Houston. Those folks that were inside the arrow, like from Independence Heights to Jacinto City, Pleasantville, kind of that circle, like an inverted C, you would see a distribution of maybe $1,000 for a FEMA payout versus maybe $90,000 for a payout outside that city. Since then, has the city of Houston, you mentioned, a really good relationships with FEMA, have they worked through the disparity in the distribution of dollars for FEMA and then some of the triggers that caused communities of color in Houston not to receive the Harvey dollars, which was kind of led to that discrimination claimed by HUD?
So the question is in relation to an equal distribution.
So I don't think it's lost on anybody that there is a disproportional recovery effort from one community to the next. It creates these wide gulfs in the wake of natural disasters. So FEMA individual assistance is administered by our Housing and Community Development Department. And there was a huge effort to better equip communities with the resources that they need to apply for individual assistance, working through our Housing and Community Development Department. And that is really centered on this idea of outreach and community engagement and work of it. So we're creating a more robust engagement infrastructure to make sure that they have the resources that they need to apply for as much funding as they require to be made as whole as possible through FEMA. FEMA assistance is limited in nature, so direct assistance for limited home repair caps out at $80,000, I think. And it is, can we create a safe, secure, livable place for someone to move back into? And then working with HUD, Community Development, Block Grant Disaster Recovery Dollars, really codify the home repairs that FEMA starts. So all of that is administered through our Housing and Community Development Department. We are working equitably, working through an equitable disaster recovery process And it's not, frankly, it's not the first time HUD has cited Houston. Our affordable housing program lost improvements to how we, we're not just, so it's not just, we're not focused just on one solution, but what does the equitable distribution of city services look like, and how do we better serve natural disasters, communities that have been adversely impacted by natural disasters. I hope that answered a bit of your question, and again, I'm always happy to put people in touch with folks who are really doing the day-to-day operation of these efforts.
Any more questions?
Hi, my name is Chris. I'm with an NPR station in Ohio. The area that I'm in, there's not really talks of buyouts right now, but one thing that is being looked into is dechannelization of, streams on farmland. And I'm wondering what your opinion is on that. I know there are federal incentive programs, but in our area, it's corn and soy, basically. And, those areas are getting flooded a lot and are, leading to issues further down the watershed. So, there have been some groups that have tried to, let the river and streams meander more, and that has been, successful to a certain extent. But I'm wondering, I guess those are kind of buyouts in a way, but incentive programs for farmers to retain their land, but to be required to, improve practices.
So the question is in relation to flooding issues on farms and how those are being addressed in buyout types of programs or incentive programs. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I would say that, for the most part, those contemplations are not taking place, right? And so, I think you heard about a few Dutch concepts earlier in this conversation relative to making room for the river, living with water. I think it all speaks back to this forward-thinking, larger-scale watershed approach to planning that is currently not happening, right? I think to your point about an understanding of what, if any, adverse impacts may come from dechannelization, we would advocate for that to be part of the contemplation process. Without knowing about the details specifically that you're looking at in Ohio, I obviously can't speak to what's happening there, but I think it's all part and parcel with this different type of philosophical thinking around how we plan for current and future farms.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
You mentioned you had multiple questions. Do you want to ask any other questions?
Maybe I'll save them for later. No one else has been quick for it.
Okay.
Sociologist from Rice University. Information on that if you want. But I want to go back to the equity issues, obviously, that many of us who were in New Orleans or experienced that. We hear about the Green Dot fiasco and the planning of the taking. And that process sort of started with imminent, I think it was the Urban Land Institute coming up with a great plan, and it had lots of words about equity and planning, and then it moved down to the local level, and the equity concerns sort of dropped out and became an efficiency development because we don't have a lot of resources, we've got to go with the market, and then the newspaper got involved and exposed that, and then there were contentions back and forth. And I just wanted to think about how it is that the equity concerns are actually going forward. We've heard a little bit about the affordable housing. I don't know what the buy-in for buyout program is, or if you can hear a little bit more about specifics on how we can get the equity concerns into the actual process as it plays out, or examples of how the council members are working with their constituents.
Well, I'll let my friend Ryan talk about buy and buyout, but with respect to the Green Dot plan, it's a good example of what not to do, right? And I think one of the things that we saw with the Green Dot plan in New Orleans is that they said that they were taking a technical approach. They were isolating those areas that shouldn't be redeveloped by virtue of the topographical conditions and the propensity to experience future floods. But if you sort of looked at that in a technical way, right, it omitted a neighborhood called Lakeview, which is a higher dollar community, right? And so there wasn't necessarily a purely technocratic approach applied. I think more importantly, community-led planning should be led by the community, and it should be democratic. Right? There should be some ability, I think Sam's talked about, to lay out a series of options and let democracy do what it does, right? Engage thoughtfully in a process with people where they live, work, and play about what the future of their community is going to look like. in my experience, I think when you do that, you end up with solutions that are going to make sense for that community and for the surrounding areas as a whole. And, you know, in 17 years later, right, when you look at that.
So with respect to the buy-in, buy-out strategy, or strategies since Hurricane Harvey, has been equity and understanding that we have created this disparity in Houston where zip codes can experience a life expectancy discrepancy of 20 years between zip codes that share a common corridor, 5 minutes away from each other, but the discrepancy in life expectancy is 20 years, the discrepancy in income is tens of thousands of dollars, the discrepancy in education is almost insurmountable. And Resilient Houston was the seminal document that really focused all city services on the equitable distribution of what we do and how we engage with the community. And really it starts with this instead of the city going to the community and talking at it, the city going to the community and engaging in a conversation with it. So this idea of community planning, this democratic concept, has been part of the city's ethos for a while. And what Resilient Houston did is quantifying on making sure that discrepancies and those disparities in equitable solutions, resilient solutions, and the buy-in buy-out strategy, the lily pad strategy, our neighborhood resilient hub conversations, executed and viewed through an equitable lens. These programs hopefully will reflect that. God willing, the creek don't rise. These programs will work toward bridging those discrepancies in life expectancy, those discrepancies in education, those discrepancies in wealth. But they have to start using the Climate Action Plan, Vision Zero, Walkable Places, all of these strategies that you've seen the city step are developed through that lens. And hopefully the product that comes out of these plans and these strategies are solutions that are scalable and equitable in nature. And we'll certainly have to make adjustments throughout the process. These are living documents. We didn't get it all right when we wrote Resilient Houston. We didn't get it. Are we making a concerted effort to engage with communities as opposed to take solutions and talk at communities?
Just real quick, first of all, Dr. Elliott is doing amazing work on buyouts, has a National Science Foundation project. I encourage you to talk with him. And my own group, they're like, who is this Jim Elliott? Can we meet with him? I'm like, I know Jim. So they want to reach out to you. And,
yeah,
and we've been talking about your stuff, and they found your stuff. He's doing remarkable work. The equity lens around buyouts, it's just not up front. It's not, they don't start with, oh, let's buy out, you know, where's the equity? They start with a BC ratio. They start with, you know, more hydrological information. It's just, it's never been there. Houston, you know, I'm convinced is turning the corner and is doing wonderful things in the last couple of years, but put that on top of, you know, decades of not thinking about that issue. The other thing just to note is that, and I say this as a PhD in planning and a longtime practicing planner, oftentimes, more than not, planning doesn't work. There is a disconnect between our competing interests, like big engineering firms and home building firms. So, and again, I'm a planner and I believe in planning, but just because it's in there as a policy or an aspirational goal doesn't mean it's going to happen. So we need to really think about the implementation and look at and hold these plans accountable to what they say. Most of them aren't regulatory, so they don't have to be held accountable, but I think it's up to the journalistic community to call out, you know, 5 years later, the plan said this, what actually happened? because that'll hold, you know, the well-meaning people who make the plan accountable to making sure that those plans can get put in place.
So we are at time.
Just really quickly, we have released the 2-year report on both the Climate Action Plan and Resilient Houston. We've released 4 annual reports on our recovery efforts. All of those things are publicly available on our website, so I'm happy to get anybody information on those things. We are also recertifying LEAP as a LEAP community. That is a comprehensive overview of all of these programs, creating those benchmarks and those things that will hold us accountable in the future. Please help us get that out to people.
Please join in thanking the panelists today. So the lunching session is starting right now. Please go downstairs and grab your lunch and head into the ballroom. If you have any questions or you want to exchange contact details, they will be around for a few minutes to do so.